Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. Oh, got a special program today. Ellen Brown is back. Her public banking conference is coming up beginning a week from today. It'll be in California. I'll let Ellen tell you all about it. Ellen's new book is all ready to roll. It's finished. I've got an advanced copy. It'll go to press. It'll be ready to be bought in short order. It's on public banking. It's the public bank's banking solution. And the book is absolutely crammed with everything you need to know about public banking and the solutions to the absolute abomination of what we call a banking system today. It's not a banking system. It's a grand theft system. Well, regular listeners to this program understand that very well. Well, it's good to see it in print. It's good to see lots of people getting behind the solution to this ugly, despicable way the country is run, the way the Western world is run, the way we need to change things. Ellen, before we get going, I just want to make another comment. And I'll bring up, I was going to bring up an email I got, but I know what I want to say. I've discussed a completely different issue on this program many times, and I'll do it again in about a week or so with another guest. It's the issue of Lynn Stewart and the fact that this glorious human being has been locked away in America's gulag for a 10-year sentence that's a virtual death sentence for her because she's not a well woman. She had cancer. It went into remission. It came back again. It's been spreading. Her health situation, dare I say, is dire. It's dire. She's getting less than third world care in a so-called prison, military. Well, U.S. prisons, I guess, are militarized in a prison hospital down in the Fort Worth area. Instead of giving her the treatment that she needs, they do everything they do to avoid it. Well, Lynn was cleared to be released, compassionate release. The warden of the principal of the prison, I don't know what kind of a guy he is, but at least he had enough compassion to realize, what in hell are we holding this woman here for in the first place? What in hell are we holding her for if she desperately needs the kind of treatment she's not getting from us, meaning them? He recommended compassionate release. That was a month ago, roughly a day or two ago. So it's over a month ago now. There has been nothing done. This could be done in 10 seconds. In 10 seconds, if the right person pulled the right trigger, signed the right document, the gates could open, Lynn could be on a plane heading for New York. Sloan Kettering Hospital, that has superb cancer treatment, is waiting for her, wondering, will she arrive, when, what's going on? Well, I wrote an article saying Obama wants Lynn Stewart dead. I absolutely believe it. He's the guy who could have avoided putting her in prison in the first place, but he made sure that she got there. I think maybe he wants to make sure she doesn't get out, or if she does, possibly it'll be too late to matter. Well, we've talked about Lynn before. We'll do it again. I wanted to bring it up yesterday, but we got deep into another discussion, and I didn't want to interrupt the train of thought in mid-thought. So I held it over just for the beginning of today's program, and I wanted to mention it. Tune in again because we'll talk more about this. I would love to have a program where I could announce on air, Lynn Stewart finally has been released. She's back in New York. She's at Sloan Kettering. She's being treated. Fingers crossed she can pull through because it won't be an easy lift to see that happens. The cancer is spread. She is really in serious condition. And how this is going to turn out, I just don't know. If she dies, and it's very much a possibility, Obama will have more blood in his hands. Let's hope that doesn't happen. Lynn deserves better. She's done so much for so many people throughout her career as a human rights lawyer, lots of times pro bono, because doing the right thing is its own reward. And Lynn understood that as well as anybody. So I'll dedicate these opening thoughts to Lynn, and I pray for her, and I think about her. She's also a friend. I've met her husband, Ralph. Both of them have been on this program. Lynn, before she was in prison about 3.5 years ago. She's got 7.5 years to go if she doesn't get out. I don't know if she'll ever get out, but again, fingers crossed she will. And I'll never stop talking about her and writing about her. I'll certainly do what I can. I can't bust open the prison and get her out, but I'll do everything I can short of that. Ellen, welcome. We'll shift to public banking now. Another crime against humanity. I mean, Lynn is one case and all the other wrongfully abused people in America's gulag, but the banking system is a greater crime, and you know that, and you can explain this a little bit. The harm it does to countless, dare I say, billions of people around the world, Ellen. I mean, it really is more than a disgrace. It's a war by other means. You can fight wars, Ellen, as you know. You can fight hot wars. You can fight financial wars. And I think the financial ones are worse.
I agree. And you could argue that the wars are there to put countries in debt so that they will be financially subservient to the City of London and Wall Street, basically.
Oh, absolutely. Get them in debt. Steal their assets. Steal their resources. Steal everything they have that isn't nailed down. In fact, everything that is nailed down. I imagine these predators are trying to strike a deal to sell the Parthenon in Greece. They're trying to figure out how to get it uprooted and, you know, something that goes back to antiquity. They don't want it to fall apart in transit, but I think they want to sell the Parthenon.
Yeah.
And everything else.
Mm-hmm. And it's unbelievable that people accept, well, they don't accept it, but we can't really do anything about it because we're not organized enough. So that's one reason I've written this book. It seems to me that we need a very large populist movement. They've got the money, but we've got the numbers. And if we could all get on the same page, get organized, know what to do, and move in that direction, we could prevail. Not that we can oppose Wall Street, but what we could do is set up our own system and just move into it. I mean, it would just prevail because we would set up a better mousetrap, and nobody would want the Wall Street version when you could get a safe version in your own local community that would serve your community, a place where you could get credit. It would be a level playing field where everybody would have a fair shot at getting the credit they need to get their businesses up and running. It's basically the American dream that everybody should have a fair chance. Well, or everybody does have a fair chance, but you don't if you don't have the ability to get credit. Credit is basically the fundamental economic need of any business, startup business. And in order for people who come into the world without rich parents, they need a bank to turn to get credit from. I mean, if you don't have rich friends or rich parents, that's what a bank is for, is to turn your promise to pay into money. The bank looks at who you are, how you're going to make the money, and stamps the approval on it and gives you these little pieces of paper that you can spend in the community, and the bank stands behind it. That's what the bank does. But the way we've set up our system now, the banks are more like tourniquets, or they have control over the flow, and they're not letting it flow into local communities. For the bank, they make the same amount of money if they make a $1 billion loan to a hedge fund as if they make a $10,000 loan to a small business. So they're just ignoring the local businesses, and we don't have, our community banks are getting bought up by the big banks. So the big banks are now in our local communities. Where we have a better model would be in Germany, for example, where they do have a very strong public banking sector, and those banks are mandated to serve their local communities. So that's what we need, another model. And so that's what I've written about, is first of all looking globally and historically at what's been done before and what works. And it's amazing what's out there. I mean, nobody's ever told us about this. You might suspect it was all hidden from us. It's not in the history books.
It's all there for people who want to take the trouble to find it out. And the first way is to read your other book, Ellen, Web of Debt, which really lays the groundwork and explains so much about systems that have worked in other parts of the world. They worked so gloriously, including in America back in colonial days. And if it worked back then, it certainly can work today. And you've written much about the Bank of North Dakota, the only state in America with a state bank. And it works wonderfully. In my own experience, not with a state-run bank, Ellen, but when I and my family first moved to Chicago, we banked at a local neighborhood bank, and I don't know who owned it, but I knew the person who ran the bank very, very well. We knew each other on a first name basis, and if there was anything that that he needed to inform me about something on my own account, I had two of them, a small business account and a personal account, anything I needed to know, and once in a while an issue came up, he'd call me on the phone and tell me, like maybe I made a withdrawal before a check I deposited cleared, so technically I overdrew my account. That happened a couple of times, not intentionally. Well, he didn't want to charge me anything. He simply wanted to inform me, and then I let him know that I made a deposit, and I guess I should have waited an extra day. And as soon as I told him that everything was fine, well, that bank morphed into a bigger one as consolidation went on, and one of the newer banks was First Chicago, that became Bank One, I think, that became J.P. Morgan Chase. And I think the only thing that could replace J.P. Morgan Chase would be Bank of the World, Ellen. when they get down only to one that runs everything, and maybe the Bilderbergs will decide that. But instead of having a neighborhood bank that serves everybody, the community is what it serves. You get these colossuses that just want to exploit you, take advantage of you, and they do it. That's all they do. And they have the full faith and blessing of the U.S. government. Instead of the government working for the people, they work against the people for these predators, these vampires. It's a terrible system that needs to be replaced. And you've done so much glorious work on this. It's why people need to read your books, Ellen. If they really want to understand the rotten system that's absolutely killing us and the right system that can save us, read Ellen's books. Read Web of Debt. Read the new book, The Public Banking Solution, and I'll let you talk about it. One more comment as well. Anybody who has ever only bought store-bought, let me say, produce, you know, the cardboard-tasting kind, and have never tasted the real stuff fresh out of the garden. I don't very often, but I have, especially at farmers markets in the summertime, where it's not exactly cut and I eat it 10 minutes later, but they cut and pack it the day before, so within 24 hours I can eat it. And the difference is so extraordinary. Well, maybe that's not the best example, but that's one example of the difference between the predatory banking system and the real thing. There really is just wonderful, that does the job it's supposed to do.
Yeah, I agree. And North Dakota is the only model we have. So, and it actually works very well. We have this Google group, and people are arguing all the time that it's not good enough, that we need, you know, that they're partnering with the private banks, and so therefore they're keeping the private banking system alive, et cetera. Well, it works. That's the first thing. It's, you can talk theory all day long, but you're not going to get politicians to do it, first of all, if there isn't somebody who's done it first, if you can't prove that this is going to work. And it seems to me, speaking of politicians, that you're not going to get them to do it, even if it does work somewhere else, unless you've got a groundswell of support. And that's why what I do and what you do too, I think, is, you know, we're just always trying to raise awareness so people see what's going on. So the first thing for taking action is you have to understand the players and what they're doing now and what the rules are now and how they could be, what the possibilities are. So,
well, absolutely. A phrase that I like, and it's not mine, I borrowed it, but the phrase that sunshine is the best disinfectant. If people know what is really going on, lay out the facts. Yeah. Get rid of the distortions, the misinformation, the managed news, the rest of it. Just lay out the facts, the truth. The truth. This is the way it is, ABC, and so on and so forth, and let people make their own decisions. Well, I just can't imagine that the great majority would not want something completely different than we have today. Of course they would, because the system we have today is eating them up. It's destroying their lives. People who are lucky enough to have jobs today, most of them have rotten jobs, either part-time, low-pay, poor benefit, or no-benefit jobs, and all of the better ones have disappeared. Paul Craig Roberts has done so much marvelous work writing about this. He's written a couple of books, I think, on it, the fact that the good jobs are in low-wage countries overseas. Well, they used to be here. I worked, what am I, my second job, out of the Wharton School was a marketing analyst for J&L Steel in Pittsburgh, when Pittsburgh used to be known as Steel Town. Well, it was kind of sooty back then as well, but there were good jobs. I went through those mills. I wouldn't want to work in one of the mills, but it was a marvelous well-paying job for people who, if the alternative would have been something much lower paying, much lower benefits. I mean, these people could send their kids to college. They could buy homes. They could buy cars. They could do things that they really struggle to do today if they could even barely possibly do them at all. But they could back then. Well, if you went back to Pittsburgh today, and if I went back to the spot, I worked downtown, but downtown was only about a mile away from the Pittsburgh works, one of the real works that was in a city. I drove past it every day from where I live going downtown to work. That's all gone. It's all gone. It's disappeared. So I don't know what they call a Pittsburgh today, but they certainly don't call it Steel City, and they don't call Detroit Motown anymore. The closest thing to Motown is to call it Ghost Town.
Right. It's horrible what's happening to Detroit. It's actually it's like Greece, or it's very like those countries that are being run by bureaucrats. I mean, it's being run by bankers, basically. They no longer have political will, or the people no longer have a voice. It's being run by a company. It's being managed by a company.
They've got a lawyer from a law firm appointed, I guess, by the corporate types to be the city manager running Detroit. He's going to strip mine everything of worth out of it and leave the people in worse shape than they are right now. This is what they do. This is the typical IMF program, Ellen. I mean, structural adjustments and the rest of it. You just grab everything in sight and leave ordinary people on their own, sink or swim. And believe me, most of them are probably going to end up sinking.
Yeah, well, that's the whole leverage buyout thing. That's what happened to General Motors. That it was basically bought out by people. I mean, it's part of the capitalist model where people can come in, buy the company, bleed it dry of its assets, and then sell it again. I mean, all they want is to get the money out. They're not looking to make a productive business. And that's why these models abroad that we don't even know about, I didn't know about them until I started writing, and you go far out. You know, you see these different things. That, for example, in Japan, they have the Keiretsus, where they are a collection of companies that work together. They have their own bank. So they're basically doing what, say, North Dakota does, you know, where they put their own revenues in their own bank, and then they can leverage it into credit the way banks do. But they're cooperating. They're working together rather than trying to just run the company into the ground and take the money, which is what the private shareholder owned model does. They actually own their own companies, and they're a cooperative group where the stakeholders are there in the group, and so it's all about preserving the business and making the business grow and competing. They compete, but they compete with other businesses, so, you know, other cooperative groups. So it's quite competitive, but on a larger level, like you have all these beehives competing with each other instead of just eating your own, parasitizing your own beehive.
Again, the system is so manipulated to benefit the few and harm the many, and it just gets worse and worse and worse as these giant oligopolies consolidate to greater size, and it's worst of all in the areas of banking and finance, where these colossuses, where they literally control everything. There's a Bilderberg conference coming up in early June. I got some information, and I wrote an article. I haven't widely distributed it yet, but I wrote an article from the little information that I got. But basically, the Bilderberg idea, along with everything else, is to have a one-size-fits-all system, especially when it comes to controlling money and finance and everything related to it. And their ideal world is a world of a classless society, I think is what they call it. But it's really not classless. It's a society of rulers and serfs. So everybody either toes the line as an obedient servant, and the masters decide everything. And if you don't go along with the system, they find a way to get rid of you. And no holds barred. And along with, they want everything militarized to be sure that anybody steps out of line, they can take action that way. But controlling money is the greatest power, and they absolutely want to do that on a one-size-fits-all system for the whole world. So this is pretty ugly stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think people, one problem is we're so divorced from the effects of what we do. For example, you can play the stock market, and you're watching your numbers going up and down, and so you get all excited because your numbers have made money. But you're not seeing what that's doing maybe to third world countries or people's food bill or, we're so divorced from the effects of what we do. It's kind of like the drone mentality where you don't have a person who's looking down and seeing what damage he's doing. You have a machine that's doing this damage, and you're just playing this computer game where you watch it fly over. So somehow we need to get the responsibility back to, well, and I think we need to get it back by getting a democracy back into this whole structure that we call civilization. In order to have a real capitalism, I mean, I'm not even talking about socialism, in order to have the capitalism that we learned in school, the one that we thought was a good thing, where mom and pop stores all competed with each other, you need a strong, publicly owned infrastructure with a set of rules that allows everybody to compete fairly. And it seems to me you need a source of credit that everybody can get, have equal access to if they qualify for it. In fact, what I've written is that the basic problem with in this book I've sort of taken the opposite position of a number of things, like fractional reserve banking I'm starting to see as a good thing. The first and second U.S. banks I'm starting to see as a good thing. It's all in how you look at it. But the fractional reserve banking would be or is a good thing if the bank is publicly owned. In other words, you need the ability to create more credit than is already out there. If you only allow people to borrow what somebody's willing to lend, I mean, let's say you started with an all-gold system and you kept it all gold and you never allowed the system to expand, and the only way you could get credit would be to find somebody with gold who was willing to give you their gold for a period of time, and they wouldn't use it. Well, if you look at the numbers, the way businesses work, you could have many times the cost of a product going out in the form of credit to build this product, because everybody in all the little companies in the line of production borrow in order to pay their workers and materials before they have a product to sell. So it's a chain going up and then a chain that comes back down when they get paid. So where are you going to find people that will give up that much gold, you know, and not touch it for the period that you're going to need it for this business? And you're going to be needing it all over and over if you're a business. You can't. So you need a system where credit is immediately available to anyone who qualifies for it. So that means credit is a different thing than what we think it is. It's not borrowing an existing thing, which we call money. Money is, right now we have this arbitrary third thing that comes in between borrower and, or between, you know, producer and labor or materials, etc. We have all these people that want to get together and produce things. Right now we have all these people out of work. We have lots of materials that are sitting there not being used. They can't get together because they don't have the money, this third thing. And the only way they can get the money is to borrow it from somebody who supposedly has the money. But when they borrow it from the bank doesn't have the money either. What they do is they create it on their books. But they have to then get it because the way the rules are set up. So every night if they, you know, you have these checks running back, flying back and forth between banks all day. And if they come up short at the end of the day, then they borrow it from whatever bank has it. So they borrow it overnight, and then in the morning they give it back. So it's all a fake, pretending that they borrowed the money when actually they just created the money. So let's get rid of all the fake stuff and just admit that what we're doing here is monetizing the credit of the borrower. If you went to, let's say you were in a small town and you went to your grocer and you said, you know me, I live down the street and you can see my crops and they're coming in, I'll pay you when the crops come in. The grocer would say, fine, and he would give you groceries. But if you're a stranger coming through town, he doesn't know you, he's not going to give you credit. So you go to the bank, which is this big building that's got stability and looks good, and the bank stamps it, looks at your bona fides, and turns your promise to pay into money. So then you can go out and spend the money, and now you owe the bank instead of owing the grocer. And the bank knows where to find you. They're hooked into the legal system, and the sheriff knows how to attach your, garnish your wages or attach your house or whatever they need to do to make sure you pay up so the system works. But the flaw, it seems to me, is not then that banks create credit, which is what we've tended to think was the flaw, we money reformers. That's where I got into it on that angle. The flaw is not that they create our money, it's that they are private. The money should be created. In other words, money is only credit. It's only at the monetization of an IOU. If we had no debt, if we had no credit, we would have no money. Our entire money supply is IOUs, except for this little bit called coins. So the snag in the scheme is that it's all filtered through these bankers, which have gotten bigger and bigger and are now able to turn the flow the way they want to turn it. So they're not turning the flow onto local business because they don't make very much money there, and it's gotten riskier and riskier with all these higher capital requirements, et cetera. They make the most money now gambling and derivatives, so why should they even bother with the local credit? So they're going into this whole different game, this quadrillion-dollar derivatives game, where they can, it's literally money-making money. I mean, there is no there except money, screaming money from other people. You're not making a product, you're making money. I mean, you could argue that it's a form of insurance, but as we know, it's a very bad form of insurance. There's no insurer that makes sure that they can pay up, and that's the reason that the Federal Reserve has had to keep the interest rates extremely low, because if the counterparties on all these interest rate swaps had to pay up, they'd be, you know, they couldn't do it. It's J.P. Morgan and Bank of America that are the counterparties on these interest rate swaps, where they get the benefit of the interest rates low, but the counterparty gets the benefit of the interest rate goes up.
Well, Japan has kept their interest rates near zero for over two decades, I guess, now, back beginning sometime in the early 1990s. I don't know when it started, but Japan got in trouble at the end of 1989, the very end, and the 90s, and the first decade of the new millennium, and right now, and all the times that reports came out that Japan was beginning to look up. Well, it looked up, and then it looked down again. You know, rolling recoveries, recessions, all kinds of problems. I can't imagine that what's going on now will have a happy ending. But interest rates have been near zero, so they've been that way in America for the last 3-4 years. Dare I speculate, Ellen, that we could literally be in the same zero-rate environment a decade from now, where people who got some kind of return on their money, if you stick it in the bank, you won't do very much better than if you stick it under your mattress. And under your mattress, it may be safer than in the bank, because if you explained, and I quoted you from what you wrote, if you stick your money in the bank, it's not your money anymore. The bank's money. What you get is an IOU. And if the bank goes bust, you could end up with nothing. And it's even worse than that, as you write about in your book, bail-ins and all the rest of the stuff, where they can simply raid your bank accounts and steal your money. And they can do it. They can say, well, we'll exempt the first so many dollars, whatever amount that is. But they can end up saying, well, nothing is excluded. We can take a percentage of your last dollar. And if things are bad enough, why not take it all? Well, this is the policy in Cyprus. It's already been enacted in Europe, in the I believe the Eurozone, or maybe it's the EU. I think it is 27 countries, and it was legislated to happen in Canada. Same thing in America. I mean, none of this stuff is operative. This is not happening today. But if there's a major crisis, instead of bailouts, it looks like the model is bail in. Well, let's give bail-in its real name, Ellen. I mean, you had grand theft under the bailouts, and this is bailout one. Bail-in is grand theft two. You know, you can steal it one way, you can steal it another way. It's still stealing, and that's the model. And we're the chumps, we're the marks, and if we don't do something about it, They've already been stealing us blind. They're not going to stop until they get everything. I think we need to take a break, Ellen. Let's do that, and we'll come back, talk about the conference, and then specifically about your book. We'll be right back. On with Ellen Brown. Ellen's got her conference, her public banking conference, coming up beginning a week from today in California. And Ellen's new book on the public banking solution is getting close to coming out of the printing process so that anybody can be able to buy it. And I hope you will. And we'll certainly be discussing it, not just today, but on future programs, because this is vital. It's vital key stuff. Money and interest run America, run the world, especially the Western world, and they manipulate it to cause so much harm to so many people. And if we don't understand the way we can get out from under them, then we're cooked. We're absolutely, I mean, they're cooking us like we're a frog being boiled slowly. They're draining everything out of us slowly and surely, and they won't stop until they get it all. And when will the mass of people wake up and realize that, my God, I mean, they've literally ruined my life. I don't know what I'm going to do now. Well, there's something we can do now, and it begins with understanding the sunshine to get the facts, and you can certainly get them from Ellen's writing. Ellen, your writing really is extraordinary. That's why I jump on new articles when you write them. And the web of debt, and now the public banking solution. I mean, this is just fundamental stuff. It should be required reading for survival. The subtitle could be a survival kit. I mean, that's literally what your writing is. You explain it as well or better than anybody I know. So I'll let you jump in and talk about both the book and the conference.
Thanks. Very nice of you. Well, the conference is June 2nd to 4th in San Rafael, California. All the details are on our website, publicbankinginstitute.org. It begins at 1 o'clock on Sunday, and in the evening from 7 to 9:30, there's a kickoff event where Matt Taibbi is the keynote speaker. And we have Birgitta Jónsdóttir from Iceland, who is one of the parliamentarians who stood up to the banks, helped mobilize the people. That's what I'm interested in, is how did they get the people mobilized to do, you know, to all push together for one thing? That's what we need to know how to do here. Mobilize the people to stand up to the banks and to say no and refuse to bail them out. And it's served Iceland very well. I mean, they pulled through it. A couple of years ago, everybody thought they were bankrupt, and now all of a sudden they're doing better than the other Eurozone countries. They're attempting to get into the Eurozone. That was the thing. That was the reason that their politicians were going to go along with the bailout, because they wanted to get into the Eurozone. But anyway, they didn't, or they haven't yet. And I guess there's a change of government now, so things may change. I don't know. And then we have Garel Pervitz, and just a long line of really good speakers. In fact, we had way too many speakers this year. It was difficult. We wound up having a full roster before we got everybody on there that I wanted to get on there.
I took a look at your line, and I said, oh, my God, this looks like a conference that would have to be running all week to get all these people in. I mean, I kept going down the list, and the list didn't seem to end. I mean, you got one speaker after another. I know a few of the people. A lot of the people I'm not familiar with, Ellen.
Yeah, well, and partly the idea is not only to... The money reformers have all, we'd be singing to the choir if we're only singing to the money reformers. So we're trying to branch out, and we're getting into more things about networking and how to build a movement, that kind of thing. So that's a different type of speaker. So the goal here is to spread information or to educate, to understand, to get the basic underpinnings of what's going on and what we could do about it, and to mobilize. That's what we're always about, is, you know, let's get out there and take some sort of action. Not that we're a political lobby or anything like that, but we're just spreading information. We're totally volunteers. Nobody gets paid. In fact, we're still in the hole for this conference. Don't ask for it. But anyway, so we're just doing it because it's, like you said, doing the right thing is its own reward. And so, I mean, I'm amazed. Of course, I'm a writer, and so I mean, I know why I do it. I'm the president, but although I don't think I meant to be the president, it just kind of came up from behind. But I wonder why everybody else does it. I mean, they're so on the bandwagon, and they just keep donating their time and just pushing, and nobody gets, you know, there's no salaries involved here. So,
oh, absolutely.
Amazing, really.
And I know a little bit about conferences because I was involved in putting them on in my small family business. I mean, you need to have a revenue source coming in to at least cover your costs. And I mean, you could really run up some
expense. That's my credit card.
Well, for us, it was a business, so we hoped that we would cover the cost and at least make a small profit. And the business we were in was very cyclical, so in good times we could do all right, but in bad times, oh boy, it was rough going getting through the storm. But it can be very expensive putting on one of these conferences.
Yeah, I heard a woman say she almost had to mortgage her house because she didn't calculate right on her conference. I thought, oh my God, I clutched my throat at that one.
Well, I know somebody who very sadly took ill a couple of years ago and passed away, but a few years before that, she put on a conference in a small...
Oh, I know who you mean.
Gadagista.
Yeah.
Gadagista. I kept close contact with her, and she had a website, and she used to publish my articles regularly. Then she left to literally help hungry people in India be fed. I mean, she literally devoted her life to doing things important to do. She asked nothing back in return, but she told me that the conference that she put on, she ended up in the hole $40,000. I think it broke her to do this thing, but she did it, and she was at a university. I think she got a lot of things either gratis or cheap, and she still ended up $40,000 in the hole to get some people that she wanted to attend. She had to pay transportation expenses. I don't know if anybody wanted to be paid to speak, but she put an awful lot of work in this thing, and again, it cost her so much. I don't think that contributed to a health problem. I think whatever she was doing abroad, I don't know what kind of illness what her health situation was when she went, but she went to India, and she spent some time there. We kept on and off contact while she was there, and when I didn't hear from her a while, and I finally found out she passed away, I was shocked. She's very sadly missed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know what she knows about public banking and what she knew, Ellen, but she would have been marvelous as a speaker, because she certainly knows the difference between doing the right things to help people and doing the wrong things, because she devoted her life to that.
Mm-hmm.
But we need a lot more people just like you, like her.
My daughter is in Basel, Switzerland, and she's actually trying to work with the Bank for International Settlements, and she knows some of those people, and you know, they're all well-meaning, like your basic bureaucrat is, or you know, your basic person that's not at the top, but just gets hired on, and they're doing their best. But the thing is, they don't. The vision isn't right. You know, they're looking at the numbers, the economic data on their computers, and they go, oh, the arrows are going up, so we must be doing a good job. But they're only looking at maintaining the banking system itself. That's their goal, is the stability of the financial system. But that the financial system is the parasite that's eating up the rest of the global economy. And so what's good for the financial system, even though we need a financial system, is not necessarily what's good for the people. So it seems to me, so of course you wind up having children, you know, that have a broader vision even than you do. I planted these seeds, so what can I say? But it seems to me that ideally it might actually be possible to bring in even the big players, because they actually are bankrupt. I mean, that's why they're doing these bail-ins, because governments globally have said, we are not going to bail you out anymore. Even the U.S. in the Dodd-Frank legislation says, if you get into trouble with another big derivatives gamble, we're not going to bail you out. So that's why they've come in with all these living wills where, okay, what are you going to do in the event that you're bankrupt? Nobody's going to bail you out, and yet you're too big to fail. You know, we can't let you fail, so now what are you going to do? So then they say, all right, fine, well, we'll convert our creditors' money into equity. It all sounds so nice, but in fact what that means is they're going to steal your deposits and give you a share in a bankrupt bank, which you can't pay your rent with very, very easily. But they are bankrupt, and I mean, it seems to me that if you put it in a nice way, I try not to be too confrontational just for that reason, that it's all politics, you know, and diplomacy. I spent 11 years in the diplomatic service. So it's all, it seems to me arguably that we could bring the big money in to, you know, we could ultimately have a global economy that actually worked, you know, that actually served all the people. Why not? The potential is there. The potential of getting everybody together to do the jobs they want to do. There's tons of work that could be done. Even in this country, we don't have to be building cars anymore. All right, so they can hire the laborers cheaper abroad. But there are all kinds of other things we could do, you know, very intelligent things. We could be developing. You hear about all these amazing possibilities of energy systems and agricultural systems and things that are just waiting to be developed. They just need the brains. They need somebody to invest in them. Well, who better to invest but the government? If we can just persuade, if the politicians themselves would just understand that it's not going to hurt anything to pump some money out there, that it's going to help. That's what we need, is to pump some money out there. Money is only credit. Actually, I was looking at my chapters to see what I would like to put, you know, on your website. You post a couple of sample chapters. So my favorite chapter, I decided, was the one on the Reconstruction Finance Corporation in the 1930s. What Roosevelt did, well, it was actually Jesse Jones. It was the man who managed the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. But I had never even heard of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation until I did this research. And here it was the largest financial institution in the world, and it funded the entire New Deal and World War II. And how they did it was they pumped credit out there, and it wasn't credit for derivatives or speculation. It all went to productive businesses. It went to what's called self-funding loans. In other words, not counting the war part, but all during the New Deal, it went to self-funding loans where these were like businesses all the way up from little tiny farms up to dams and really big things, or Bay Bridge, that sort of thing. So they were funding things that paid back. So you put the credit out there first, and then you pay the workers and the materials, they build something, and then say it's the Bay Bridge, then you charge tolls, and the tolls pay the thing off. And because you're the government lending at very low interest, it gets paid off quite quickly. You don't have to do these outrageous things that local cities like in California are doing now, where they're winding up paying something like 9 or 10 times the principal off into far into the future. Like, they don't have to pay anything now, but in 40 years they're going to have to pay 10 times what they started with. It's unbelievable what they're doing in the way of financing, because they can't get the money any other way. People just don't understand that it's a good thing to pump credit out there first. Credit is what you need to build and to get people employed. In order to have a job, somebody's going to have to pay you, and that means the money has to come from somewhere. But what is money? It's just an IOU. It's just an acknowledgement that you've done labor for the group, and we, the group, therefore agree that you can spend your little receipts on our products that we, the group, have made. That's what a national currency is. It's like a big community currency, but it's on a national level.
You know, it's
it's very sad, and I hope I'm wrong, but I feel that the part of the dirty game is to do just the opposite of that. Literally, I mean, America is basically a service economy, and except for the high-paying jobs, the big financial ones and others like it, certainly lawyers and doctors and accountants, those kind of folks, that's fine, but you need special training for that. But for ordinary folks who simply want to get through college or whatever, maybe grad school, and take a job that exists in greater numbers in business or whatever, I think, or in industry, in factories. Well, those jobs, most of those jobs have disappeared, and I think that was part of the scheme, which is really wrecking the country by doing that, but other jobs as well, and I think the idea is literally to have a rather simple workforce of dispendable people that you can employ on and off as you wish, part-time, temp, low pay, poor benefits, heading for maybe no benefits at all, everybody on their own, sink or swim, and I think this is the kind of society that's being literally molded deliberately. So instead of building one where people can elevate themselves, the America that existed post World War II, where you could get a very cheap loan and build a home and buy a car and send your kids to college. And I remember writing about the cost of these things back in the post war 40s and the 50s. I mean, it's shocking for people who don't realize that you could buy a decent home at the end of World War II for $5,000. $5,000. Uh-huh. In 1960, I bought my first car for $600. It was a Volkswagen, a brand new Volkswagen for $600. My freshman tuition at a pretty good school, full year, $600. $600.
Yeah. And today, mine is free. I went to Berkeley.
Berkeley was free. There were many state schools that were free. I didn't check the University of Illinois where I live, but University of Illinois might have been free. University of California was free. Was Reagan the first one who changed that?
Well, I know it was Prop 13 that changed the whole tax structure, so they didn't have the money anymore. I'm not sure exactly where it probably was Reagan. But I know now at UCLA, I went to UCLA for $600 a year tuition. It's now $35,000 a year for an in-state student. This is a state school, a state-supported school, University of California, Los Angeles. So $45,000 if you're an out-of-state student. So it's unbelievable. I mean, and then now we're – oh, that's another thing I'd like to talk about is Elizabeth Warren's education bill. I think that's a great idea, that the students would be refinanced at 0.75%, which is the rate at which banks can borrow from the Federal Reserve. Why not? And then I saw the objections. Well, she's obviously just politically, it's just political grandstanding because she knows it can't happen because you've got to take into account the defaults and the fact that these are long-term loans. These are not overnight loans like the banks get from the Federal Reserve. But you also have to take into account that we're not talking about a private bank here that has to worry about defaults. We're talking about the U.S. Education Department. The U.S. government could write off those loans. I mean, if you're talking about the Federal Reserve, they are the lender of last resort. They can create that money on their books. We should have given those kids free tuition in the first place, but since we didn't, the very least we could do for them, it seems to me, is to give them virtually interest-free loans. It's been done before. It's been done in Australia and New Zealand, where they give interest-free loans to students, and if they pay them back, great. Then they're called a loan, and they pay it back. You know, if they get a job and they can afford to pay it back, then they pay it back. But it was interest-free, so they don't have that much to pay back. They can afford it. And then they take the money and they lend it to somebody else. It's a revolving fund. But if they don't pay it back, they say, fine, they write it off because they are the government and they have the power to do that. And it certainly hasn't broken their country. And if you look at China, that's what they do routinely. That's what they always did, of course, when they were communists, when they were literally communists, where money was something else than what it is today because they owned everything. So, and they, of course, could issue the money. So they issued the credit. So they paid workers and materials. But it was more just like an accounting function, like just let's just see how much it cost us to run this state-owned enterprise. And then if it makes money, great. Then it shows on the books as a as a net earner, and if it doesn't make money, well, that's interesting, and they write it off because it's their money. They create the money in the first place. It's all just, they're just looking at to see what works and what doesn't in one big beehive where the beehive overall is doing very well. I think it's a known fact that if you invest in, so somebody from Australia was saying this, if you invest in 10 little businesses, 9 of them are probably going to fail, but one of them will hit it big. So you have to look at the whole pot. The pot itself is a productive venture, even though 9 out of 10 of them failed. So that's what you can do with the students. If you allow these students to have a chance at life here, so they can, instead of paying back their loans with their meager little salary that they're managing to make these days, if any, let them spend some money on, let them buy a house and a car and furnish the house and all the things that young people spend on. That's where you get the stimulus for the economy, is get the young people out there shopping like they should be. I know there's an argument about, well, then they're going to use up too many resources and we don't want all this shopping for things you don't really need. But what about shopping for things you do really need and things that will get things moving again, you know, things that businesses need in order to grow and develop and to hire more people and to create. We need to create some infrastructure here. Our infrastructure is falling apart, and we need more teachers. We need to put all those things back in the schools that we used to have that actually made for a high quality of life, like art and sports and history. Well, I guess they have history. I think they took out civics. Civics was my favorite class. Did they take out civics because they don't want people to know how the government works? I don't know. Anyway, oh, there's so many things that could be done if we had the funding.
Well, we have the funding, Gail, and if we could only spend it for the right things, for growing people's lives and the economy and the overall health, and instead we spend it on militarism and all the other horrible things. You wrote about Roosevelt's Second Bill of Rights. I have a chapter in my Banker Occupation book about it. It had wonderful provision. It was also the so-called Servicemen's Readjustment Act. Anybody ever hear of that? The GI Bill. Returning vets could go to college or vocational schools. They could do it and get unemployment insurance while they were going to school. They could get a low-interest, no-down-payment loan to buy a new home that, as I said, you could buy it for $5,000 or even less. And Roosevelt's Second Bill of Rights. How many have ever heard of Roosevelt's Second Bill of Rights? In 1944, shortly before he died in 1945, I guess it was. I think it was 1945. Well, yeah. It was April. April 44. It wasn't 44. April 1944. I mean, employment with a living wage. Get rid of unfair competition. Housing, universal housing, medical care, education, on and on. I mean, these are the things we're destroying today, Ellen. We're just about out of time. Let me give you the last few thoughts. I mean, this is what this guy talked about then. He wasn't perfect, but this is what he proposed. I wish he did it a half a dozen years earlier. But instead of opposing these things now, we're systematically destroying them.
Yeah, and like you say, nobody's heard of that, and nobody's heard of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which was the largest financial institution in the world for 20 years. Now, why has nobody heard of it? Because it proves that a government bank works. In other words, public banking, public financing works, and it works really well. But it was competing with their monopoly. So they now own the media, so we don't hear about it. They own the history books, too.
Oh, indeed. Public banking indeed works. When people control their own money, they use it to help themselves. When private parasites control the people's money, they steal it from us so that they can benefit. We sure can change that, Ellen, if enough people wake up and realize how we've been scammed, and they don't have to go out and throw bombs. They just have to rally other people en masse And when enough people do those kinds of things, history shows that results follow. They never happen quickly or easily. It can take many years, but when finally people say we won't take it anymore, and they really mean it, then we really can get the kind of change that's needed. And it's possible it can be done. I hope I could live long enough to see it. I doubt it, but I never give up on these hopes and dreams. I think that music is telling me we're out of time. Ellen, again, your new book, The Public Bank Solution, and your conference in California, you can go to Ellen, you Google Ellen Brown, you'll get information on the Public Banking Conference in California, June 2nd to 4th, and at least if you can't attend, you can see who's coming, you can see some of the things that are being discussed. Ellen, I wish you well. I'll be thinking about you all next weekend before Sunday the 2nd, and then you can let me know how things went after it's all over.
Okay, great.
Thanks, Ellen.
Great talking to you, Zari.
Join us again next week, Fridays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, and on weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, for real news and information, the kind everybody needs. Make it a regular habit.